Welcome to another fabulous sport and lifestyle biz here on your Real Feel Good Radio, UK Health Radio. Well, we have a super interview today. The inspirational and incredible Sophie Blake, part of a previous interview with some new updated inserts, all in preparation for our latest segment from Sophie in a couple of weeks, detailing how she's moved forward with treatment with her life and all the incredible work she's doing for charities all over, including ourselves. Throw in our SLB Sports Roundup, and it is a bumper show, and we hope you enjoy it. Well, hello, everybody. This week, I'm joined by a very special person, media personality, Sophie Blake. Hi, Sophie. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you, John?
Really doing well, thank you. Not enjoying it when I'm looking out of the window, but apart from that, yeah, already rolling in 2023. What about you?
Yeah, it's rubbish. I hate weather. I'm one of those people that wants January and February to just go fast forward and just head into the spring. I just hate looking at this miserable weather and this non-stop rain and the grey and the fog. And I'm just a summer person. I love the summer.
Yeah. And obviously you're in a fantastic part of the world to enjoy it as well when it's nice.
Yeah, very, very lucky. And that's why I moved here. I love the beach. So fortunate that a lot of people don't realise as well how lucky we are around here. We're surrounded by the South Downs, which is just beautiful. And you've got about 180 miles worth of walks, really pretty, like little Sussex countryside villages and really nice pubs. So to live here with a dog is just fantastic. You've just got a bit of everything. City by the sea, but I can be in London in an hour. So it's great.
Yeah, perfect getaway from the rat race, as it were.
Really, it is. And you can see that in the summer, though, when it's when the beach is just full of, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and yeah, it's crazy. But we know the quieter areas to get off
that's
to,
good.
So that's not too bad.
And you also when to escape if you need to.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. But then I've got a teenage daughter, and she loves it when it's like that. Her and her friends, they all head down to the beach where the crowds are.
Yeah.
They love having all that life around them. So for them, it's just fantastic. They love it.
Yeah, perfect. Sounds brilliant. And obviously, you say you've got a teenage daughter. She's going through exams at the moment. Obviously, being a mum, it's another trying time in a way.
Yeah, she's doing her mocks at the moment. So she had a load of mocks in November, and then they do them twice now before they do their GCSE. So she's currently doing the next round of mocks. So yeah, so she had that hanging over her for Christmas. So that's what she's busy doing at the moment. So she's got two solid weeks every day of exams, and then a break again, lots more studying, and then heading up into doing the GCSEs in the summer. And I can't believe my little baby is doing GCSEs and then heading off to sixth form. It's mad. It's just gone so quickly.
If she stays on, she stays on. But effectively, it could be the end of school. She's that age.
She is. She's going to stay on. She's applied to lots of colleges. Her plan is to carry on studying. Wonderful. She's massively into music. So, you know, that's what she's really hoping to get into. So they've got the pressure on them to do well, to get those exams, to get into them more. But, you know, we're going to work hard. I'm her revision buddy. I'm rubbish. I mainly provide snacks, teas. Like, do you want a bath run? Blah, blah, blah. But when it comes to maths and science, I'm like, should we watch a YouTube tutorial? Because I'm no good whatsoever with those.
You sound like the perfect revision buddy.
I try.
You mentioned that Maya's into music. We'll perhaps come on to that a little bit later when we're talking more about now and things that might happen in music and her pathway. Obviously, we've got you onto the radio to talk about yourself, both, you know, personal and what you did in the media and in sports. But I could just take it back to the start, really, so people can get to know you, Sophie. What was it like, you know, growing up? You were studying. What did you study? How did you get into media at a young age?
So I kind of fell into media by accident, really. When I was at school, I was diagnosed at 15 with dyslexia. Really great teacher I'd always known for a really long time, an English teacher. Back in those days, you know, in the 80s, it was a lot harder to get diagnosed then. And dyscalculia, so really bad with maths and numbers. So I got diagnosed finally at 15. But in those days, they just used to give you like an extra 10 minutes or half an hour in your exam. So it wasn't much help.
No.
But I was very creative. So my things were, I did love history and did really well in history. I did love English literature, theatre, drama, art. So that was the side that I went to. And then I did my A-levels. Then I did a foundation course at the Actors Institute up in London. And then I became your typical, worked in bars and restaurants.
Right, okay.
When you want to kind of get into that industry. And I was terrible at actually ever doing an audition. I had no confidence, which is so sad. I look back and think, God, why didn't I actually go for it and push myself forward? But I just really lacked in confidence to do things like that. But I discovered that working in bars and restaurants, I could save up loads of money quite quickly with tips and not spending hardly anything, and then just go traveling. And I got the travel bug.
Wow, yeah.
So I did that until I was about 25.
Nothing wrong with that.
It was only going to be like a year or two. And then I was like, oh, hang on, but then I want to go here. And I just loved it, really loved it. So, yeah, worked in bars and restaurants for a long time. And I did really enjoy that. I made great friends, still got some lifelong friends from doing that as well. And it was really good fun and got to see lots of lovely places. And then I became a supervisor in a Mexican restaurant and just had that kind of epiphany one day of just thinking, I really want to do something else now. And that's when my life changed in a completely different direction. A guy came in who was launching a new internet style TV. I think it was going to be a shopping channel. It never materialized. It didn't happen. But he was a customer and said, you know, would you be interested? Have you worked in TV or have you done modeling and blah, blah, blah? And I said, no. He was like, well, come along and do these interviews, meet the other women, the girls doing it. So I did. And funnily enough, we did all the press interviews. There still wasn't a channel.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was hilarious. We were doing all these photo shoots and we were doing articles in like the Evening Standard about this TV channel that was going to be launching and blah, blah, blah. Then it didn't materialize, but it made me think, well, okay, I've done these shoots. So I phoned up a couple of model agencies because obviously the internet didn't exist then and sent the photos off and got an agent. So I was quite old getting into modeling. I was 26.
Yeah.
But back in those days, I don't know if things have changed in terms of that, but you needed to be over 22 or 23, it could be completely wrong, that to be able to do alcohol and cigarettes and advertising at that point, okay, you had to be a bit older. So like one of my first jobs that they sent me for a casting for was like a Bacardi's ad. It was a nationwide one in pubs and then like a case cider. And I just started doing things like that really and did a lot of, you know, editorial advertising campaigns. And then through that, I made the connections with people in television. Because they were like, well, you're good at talking. When I'd be on shoots and yabbering away to everybody, have you thought about going into TV? And I was like, well, no, I haven't actually. You know, I thought I would have missed the boat. And then a guy I was working with said that they had a company and they were looking for a presenter down in Southampton to do beach volleyball show. Oh. Did I want to go for an audition? The Granada TV that existed at the time down there. So I went down, did a screen test. Got the show, but the show got axed before it launched.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was one of those when I thought, oh, well, that would have been fun, but, you know, never mind. But then they contacted me about a week or two later and they said, look, we need another presenter. There's a show that's already been on for a season called Footy Shorts, which is on Channel 5. Would you like to come down and do a screen test for that? So I did that, and it was interviewing Premiership footballers in the back of a car in a limo in a section called Stars in Cars. And then I got that job. So yeah, I ended up like a week later sitting in the back of a limo interviewing like Rio Ferdinand and Frank Lampard and these people. And yeah, got to travel around the country. And then I started doing lots of the actual main segments of the show as well. Yeah, that was just brilliant. So I literally fell into it, all of it.
Yeah.
Just kind of by mistake. I was just really lucky. Just made the right connections at the right time. And I had an absolute ball doing that show. We traveled all over. I got like flown to LA to do an interview with Jürgen Klinsmann when he was living out there. And it was only a half an hour interview, but we were out there for like 5 days.
As you do.
Yeah, we felt a few links, but it was back in the day when they were just going, well, you know, you're here, you might as well just go and have some fun. And I was with this brilliant cast that I worked with on that show, and we just had so much fun and we just did loads of stuff like that. So I did quite a lot of stuff with Channel 5 for quite a long time, and that's basically how I landed myself a TV career.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, sometimes that is how it is, you know. They say, you know, things happen for a reason. There's a few quotes in the world, and that's one of them that I believe that actually are said for a reason, if that makes sense. You know, things do happen for a reason. Sometimes you sit back and think, wow, that wasn't very nice. Why did that happen? And 3 months, 6 months, 2 days, 2 years down the line, you think, well, if that had happened, I wouldn't be where I am now. One thing I want to just touch on, if you don't mind, because it's quite relevant to people that I've interviewed and I work with. There's a jockey, well, she's an ex-jockey now. Sadly, she had some bad experiences and she left the sport, but she's from Italy, and people moan about the British racing school, oh, it's difficult to get through. She came over to England, and with 18 months, she'd gone through the whole British racing school, and she's dyslexic, and she learnt English. That was inspiring. And there's another girl who coaches our girls who is dyslexic, and we do scholarships for girls to go and study and play football, or soccer as they call it in America, and under education, get a degree and play football. She's dyslexic, and if it hadn't have been for the fact she didn't have the confidence to go away for 4 years. One of the coaches I worked with over there had written her a coaching so that she could have gone over and done very minimal written stuff, but she was still willing to do it. She's dyslexic as well. So yeah, they're very inspirational. So the fact that you, after being diagnosed with dyslexia, and it was a lot harder then, trust me, I'm not dyslexic, but I know people that were, or that thought they were when I was at school.
Mm.
To actually go and have a media career, which you have done. You've done a bit of modelling, you've done TV. How inspirational. Yeah. You must feel inspired when you look back and think how you could have inspired people with dyslexia to show that it's not impossible.
I hope so. And there were parts of it where it definitely did hinder things. Like when I started working with Sky Sports, they put me forward for a couple of times to work on the Sky Sports News on the live desk.
Yeah.
So when I did the screen test for that, that was horrendous for me, because you're reading an auto cue, and when you're reading an auto cue and you're being thrown all the names of different footballers and sports people from all over the world, and it's fast and it's rolling, and I didn't have time to learn it like you would do a script.
Yeah.
I was appalling. I could not keep up, because I have to do things phonetically. So when I worked with Channel 5 and I used to record lots of the late night sports shows throughout the evening, we would do that as pre-records, and I would go through the auto cue first, and I would have everything rewritten for myself phonetically, so I would be able to say them, so that I could look at it and go, okay, this is how I would say that, this is how I would say this, blah blah blah. But I couldn't do it live. I could do live TV, but I could do live auto cue reading, because I didn't have the brain to ratio of trying to figure out what I was reading in time. Just wouldn't work. And I think it caused quite a lot of amusement, because I didn't tell Sky at the time that I was dyslexic. I didn't tell them for quite a few years.
Right.
Because I didn't want to not get the job. Yeah. And so I think they just thought that basically I was an appalling reader.
So basically, in your mind, because of your dyslexia, you thought it was better to be considered terrible at one aspect of the job, but brilliant at another, in order to perhaps keep your foot in the door, as it were.
Because it was also, you know, I was, 2003 when I joined Sky. You know, we're dealing a lot with numbers, and, you know, but when you're doing live TV, especially my main thing was Speedway for years.
Yes.
I was dealing with scores. Live scores,
yes.
The numbers that the riders were wearing, and it was literally, I would write little notes everywhere to remind myself, because I'd be reading things and my brain mentally was exhausted at the end. My way of coping with it, and like I said, I didn't tell anyone when I went for the screen test, and I didn't actually say anything, I don't think, until I stopped doing it. I have folders at home. I would colour code everything about, you know, every team, every rider, the clubs, the history, for the Grand Prix and then for the clubs. And then I would make notes before every live meeting that I would go to.
Yeah.
I would have notes with me, and then I would have a little book on a file in front of me, and I would have notes everywhere in different colours, because that was my way of working for me to be able to go, okay, this is this. But the numbers, when that was coming through so much with scores, and then you're adding up the scores and blah, 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 my brain would feel fried at the end. Yes. It really did. I did it.
Yeah.
You know, I did do it, and you have to find what works for you. So I knew what my strengths were and I knew what my weaknesses were. So, you know, just avoided doing those and go for what I was able to do.
No, absolutely. And, you know, it is inspirational. I was actually going to ask you, remembering back to when you were presenting Speedway, from my point of view, and I know it was a long time ago, you know, it never stood out, if that makes sense. It was never you know, she shouldn't have the job. Do you know what I mean? It was never like that. And I wondered what your coping mechanism was, or whether you've obviously got notes, but being live, when you do interviews, there's obviously questions that you throw out from your answers. Was it just basically also relying on your knowledge of the sport?
I would do loads and loads of research. I'd never been involved in Speedway when I started presenting it. Yeah. I'd only seen one or two live Speedway meetings beforehand. So I literally was starting from the bottom and working my way up. I just didn't have hardly any knowledge of Speedway. Right. So it was a massive learning curve. I also had never worked in live TV. Everything I did with Channel 5 years before that, and bits and pieces with BBC and ITV, were all pre-records. So it was a massive learning curve, and I was really chucked in at the deep end. You would have a producer, depending on who you're working with. People would feed you things in your ear, especially when I was starting, but it would be really difficult to hear. Then, because you're in the pits, and when the bikes were revving and the engines were revving, the noise was unbelievable. Yeah. So we used to wear cans back then. Do you remember those? Those really big clumpy things on your head that would be like a vice.
Yes.
So you would have the noise coming out in one ear, a director in another ear, a producer in another ear, countdowns going on, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's crazy. So I decided what worked for me better. was to turn them off. Yeah. And I would just do loads and loads of research. And I'd have a floor manager a lot of the time that would just count me down. Or in my ear, they would just say, oh, Sophie, you know, throw to the studio or throw to the comms, blah, blah, blah. Because again, when I'm trying to think everything through with the way my brain was working, I didn't need that noise coming from every direction. So I just like to have the calmness in my head, listen to the interviews and respond to an interview as it was happening. So again, that was all a learning curve because it was all completely new for me. And then after I'd had a bit of time off, after I had Myra and went back with Eurosport, and then they no longer had the big cans, it was just earpieces. That was lovely because it just made such a difference to all that noise going on and what you could feed out and listen to. Yeah, so that was how I worked. I literally would just do loads of prepping. Loads of research.
Hard work, isn't it? It's what you put into things, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. You can't just turn up and just think it's going to work. Because, yes, you can do an interview about that particular race that you've just witnessed, but if you want to kind of get into a bit more depth about riders and clubs and you want to talk to them about, okay, because in your last meeting you had this issue with the bike, or, you know, you've been having some issues, you know, psychologically with how things have been impacting you and blah, blah, blah. You can't feed on with anything if you're not making those studies and learning about everyone that you're dealing with to get a personal aspect in as well, you know. And so that's how I worked and that's how I did it for me personally. I know everybody has their own different ways. Some people don't really need to do that much prepping. Their brains just store all the information perfectly, whereas with me, I was a big prepper before every show.
Yeah, that's good, and that's still important.
Yeah,
it showed, as I said, and I'm not just saying that, it never stood out. So that was your prep. Yeah, all credit to you. So you've done a lot in television.
Yeah, no, I haven't worked in TV for quite a few years now. Yeah. But yeah, when I did, and I did lots of different things for Sky, and, you know, great time. I got to travel the world and just have all these amazing experiences. You know, it wasn't just Speedway, pool, Fishmania,
Moscone Cup,
but in table tennis, Moscone Cup. Yeah. Bowling, yeah, the Super Bowl parties. Those Super Bowl bashes were great fun.
Yeah.
The last one I did of those, funnily enough, I was 6 months pregnant with Maya. That was one of the last ones I did for those because I just went on crutches because my hip went out.
Oh, wow.
So I was trying to look all glamorous walking around this big party with this big bump and this sparkly top on, and we would do these interviews, throw the crutches on the floor, do an interview, and then quickly pick them up again so I could hobble over to the next one.
There you go. Look at that. That's dedication. So we've done your TV career, Sophie, and I hope you don't mind. We're going to move on to slightly more personal stuff now. You were diagnosed with Asherman's syndrome.
Asherman's syndrome, yes, that's correct.
2009. I mean, are you happy just to briefly explain what that involves to people that don't know what it is and how it affected your life and what changes you had to make?
Yeah, so basically when I had my daughter, I had what's called a retained placenta when I was giving birth. The placenta didn't come out, so I was hemorrhaging, so it was really bad. And they had to do an emergency D&C, which is where they do a blind scrape with a metal instrument.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not done under guided ultrasound. They're doing it blind. They can't see what they're doing. And unfortunately, 2 weeks later, there were still bits and pieces left inside. So the early start of, you know, getting blood poisoning and everything. Rushed in for another emergency D&C, did the whole lining, and then it was kind of left, right, okay, go off, live your life type thing, you know, be a mum. And it was quite obvious to me very early on that something wasn't feeling right. And I kept saying to the GPs and the midwives when you're seeing them for your checkups afterwards and told, no, there's nothing wrong. But I was in so much pain. And I'm like, that's just your womb recovering and all these things. They were doing the hormone test and you're saying there's nothing wrong. Your levels are fine. But I just knew that something wasn't right. I was having this terrible pain monthly, and I don't know how much you want to get involved in the information of it all, but basically I wasn't having periods, they didn't return, but every month I was having horrendous pain, that like debilitating pain when I couldn't move. And eventually I had some scans, didn't show anything up. I did lots of my own research and I found, and again it was before all these support groups were set up, and it was like a Yahoo support group for people that I found online of this thing called Asherman syndrome, for if you'd had a D&C and issues it could cause. So found this group called Asherman's, and I had like ticked the boxes for everything, went to my GP and said, I think I've got Asherman syndrome. No, I spoke to the gynae consultant I was seeing. No, you could possibly have it, you know, it's one of those things. 30 years I've never seen. So they went to do a hysteroscopy where they just kind of take a look about what's going on inside. Couldn't get free because basically my whole entire womb was a ball of scar tissue. And what had happened is that when my body was trying to heal, because it had been so aggressively done, they literally scraped away the entire wall of the lining. Look, other things can cause this as well. Any trauma to the womb or the uterus can cause this scarring to happen, but a DNC is one of the main causes of it. And unfortunately, it's one of those things that far more people suffer from than people are aware of. Doctors aren't trained for it. So when nurses and doctors and even midwives do all their training, they're not taught about Asherman syndrome or what to look for. So I had loads and loads of operations to try to remove the scarring. It would just keep growing back. So basically my periods had just been being reabsorbed into my body. There was nowhere for it to go. So that's what the horrible pain was. The adhesions were then forming around everywhere else. So in the end, I was trying for another baby at the time.
Right.
Really wanted to have another baby with, you know, to give my daughter a brother or sister. So I had done all these operations, but even was trying IVF when I'd have an op and they'd go, this is your optimum window, you know, do the IVF. So every time I was having all of these, I was getting pumped full of HRT as well. Right. So all the hormones going in. I did get pregnant. I had a miracle pregnancy after being told that, you know, it wasn't going to work. The IVF had failed. But unfortunately, because of the Asherman syndrome and the scarring, I had something called placenta previa at 17 weeks, which meant the placenta ripped up. So I lost the baby because of that, and just the most horrible hemorrhage. Here at Brighton, I was visiting my sister for a day, and it happened here in Brighton, actually, and they saved my life.
Radio. UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Radio. UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
So I spent a lot of time working with the Asherman support group over the years, became the ambassador for the UK being involved with that. And we set up doing fertility shows and going to stands, going to doctors, going to midwives, going to medical talks, you know, and did YouTube videos with some of the specialists in the UK, do a lot of education, lots of interviews, lots of meetings. So that was part of my life for a really big time. I thought that was my big health battle. I thought that was going to be, you know, the thing. Went through and did my campaigning for. I met amazing women through that, who are now fantastic friends, going back, you know, because Maya's going to be 16 this year. So, you know, 14 years of friendship, 14 and a half years with a lot of these women from all over the world. And we try and meet up and stuff, which has been lovely. But yeah, so that's basically what Asherman syndrome is. And it's getting more recognized now, but it's still something that not enough doctors, and the medical community and gynaes know about. The mantle's been passed on to the new generation who have set up all these amazing websites and support groups and Facebook and all the things that didn't exist when I was doing it. So the mantle's been passed on a few years ago. I stepped back about 4 years ago now from doing all the fertility shows and everything, just kind of, you know, felt like it was ready to move on because the treatments for it and the doctors and everybody that I'd been involved with and the consultants had all kind of moved on as well. So it was time to pass the mantle over for that. I still get people contacting me about it, you know, and I can pass on my information, but I'll point them in the right direction of who they need to talk to nowadays, because my knowledge of that is.
And great, as you said, that the baton or the mantle, as you said, has been passed on. Children are wonderful with the internet and things like that these days. So that's only a good thing. But you've given us a link actually in your answer to the next question, which is, you said that you thought that was going to be your main health battle. Well, obviously that means you have another one. Please just tell us a little bit about that and what you're going through, how it's changed your life, how you're looking forward.
Okay, so then when we went through the lovely pandemic, didn't we? That was really nice. Being locked in. And basically, I, like many people, you know, I miss the gym. I miss being stuck at home and did all the Joe Wicks workout. Thanks, Joe. Did all of that at home. And I'd never been into running. And I started running as soon as you were allowed to go outside. I was like, I need to do something that gets me outside and gets me out and about. So I thought, I'm just going to start doing some runs. And I noticed after a couple of weeks, I was feeling this pain in my breast, which I thought, you know, is maybe just because my body's not used to running. Yeah. Maybe it's not a great sports bra, you know, and all these things. But then something just started to really niggle with me that it was going on for a couple of weeks. And I've always used to be going to the gym anyway, so I know about, you know, your muscles aching at first and then it gets better and blah, blah, blah. So the something is just not right. Yeah. And then one night I moved in my sleep and I felt something inside, very, very hard to describe what it was because I couldn't feel a lump, but I felt that there was something inside that kind of moved in a slightly different direction to how I moved. So that morning I was like, right, this isn't right. Something's wrong. Phoned my GP, very fortunate because of the waiting list being horrendous. Because I described what it was, I got in within a couple of days. She took a look, also couldn't really feel anything, but said, oh, maybe it feels a bit fluidy. But, you know, I was 48. And she was like, so let's book you in. It's probably the menopause and it's just changes in the breast. If we're going to get you on HRT or anything, you know, let's start that straight away. She was brilliant like that because I know a lot of women have HRT issues. She wanted to get me on it. So let's just send you for a check, a mammogram, because I'd never had one before we go down that route. So about 2 weeks later, I've gone for this mammogram. The consultant there, I've explained to him what's going on. He's had a feel, couldn't feel anything either. So he said, right, we'll just tick the boxes, do a mammogram while you're here, and then we can tell your GP you can get in your HRT. So I'll go for the mammogram, have it done, and immediately I saw the nurse's face as she's doing it. There's a couple of whispers. They look again. They do another angle. I come out and they said, we need you to go and have a scan. We need to do an ultrasound on there now. And I was like, right, okay. Go and have that done. And they said, right, they're doing it. And they said, we need to do a biopsy right now. Are you okay to do a biopsy? So I was like, okay, that's fine. Yeah, kind of, this is all very surreal. Literally, I had completely mentally prepared myself for the fact that this was just a checkup. And they said, most likely thing is, you know, change in the breast, cyst, whatever like that. They did a biopsy. I wasn't quite prepared for that because that makes a very interesting loud clacking, clicking noise as it goes in. And it had to go really deep because what they discovered and what they could see was right against the breast wall. Walled out of that room, they take me into another room with a glass of water. And I'm like, okay, this is looking a bit more serious. The faces are very serious in there. And they said, 100% you have invasive breast cancer. And I was like, do we not need to wait for the results? You know, how long are they going to take? 2 weeks? And they were like, no, 100% you have invasive breast cancer. Yeah. And I was on my own because this is after the second lockdown, you know, and so you still had to go to all of your appointments alone. You couldn't take anyone with you. So my mum had come to stay the night before. She normally lives in Florida most of the time, and she was over and had stayed the night. So she was at my house. So I've left and I phoned her up and I'm like, oh, I've got breast cancer. And she just met me and we went to a pub because we're both sitting there kind of like, what? We just ordered a bottle of wine, just sat there kind of shaking, digesting it, going, right, okay, let's get this plan. What are we going to do? How are we going to do it? And we're both thinking, okay, well, we're going to wait this 2 weeks though. We've got this 2 week wait for the results and just hope that they've got something completely wrong. My daughter came home from school, so we sat her down and just talked to her and explained. I was in quite a lot of discomfort from the biopsy because it's quite painful and I was very bruised, very bruised. So I needed to explain, you know, why I couldn't move properly around that area and things. So we had a little chat and I'd already discussed with the Macmillan nurse before I left, is it, it's a good idea to talk to her? She was 13 at the time. What do? I wait? They said the best thing is always just open, because kids know and they'll sense something anyway. So to just be completely open, but, you know, not making it too scary. They weren't offering support then at the time because, again, because of COVID, you could have had family support and counselling and all these things. Nothing was coexisting alongside treatment then. She handled it amazingly. We were very positive and they were positive, you know, caught early, blah, 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 fantastic. So 2 weeks later, the results came in. Yes, it was cancer. Then I went through the horrible time of waiting for a bed because they were announcing the third lockdown. They couldn't get me a bed anywhere. So yeah, it was a really frightening time. That month was, I think, one of the worst of my life because it was literally, we can't get you a bed. We can't get you a bed. Phone calls every day. No, nowhere in East Sussex can we get you a bed. They've all been handed back over to COVID patients. And then I was called then a few weeks later and just said, maybe even probably even wasn't a few weeks, it's probably like a week and it felt like a few weeks, and just said, we don't know if we can get you a bed. We might just have to start you on a hormone blocker because we literally have no idea if we can book you in and do surgery for you. My mum, who was over, just went on full on phoning up every private hospital that she could, which was just so lovely. She just kind of went into mum mode. She's like, we're going to book you in. I don't care what it costs. We're going to do this. We're going to find you one. She got me an appointment at a hospital and I do not take this for granted at all, how lucky I was that she did this for me. Her and my stepfather, they got me a meeting with a doctor who had one appointment that had been cancelled that night at 7 o'clock, went for this meeting and he's like, right, I can get you in on the 7th of January. this was just before Christmas when I'd had this meeting. He said, because, you know, we're still with everything going on with COVID, but they were still all closing up for Christmas things. So that was a long Christmas because I could feel it inside me. I knew what it was. I then spent the whole of the 6th of January waiting all day by the phone because you had to get the phone call to say that it was still going ahead because appointments were being cancelled at that point every single day because of COVID then going crazy. And I'd had to isolate after Boxing Day to not see anyone, to not risk getting an infection. My mum moved in with myself and Maya. She moved in with us just in case the lockdown went on longer and if I needed to have chemo because none of these things we knew at the time. So she actually moved in, bless her. And we sat on that evening watching the big January insurrection happening in Washington whilst waiting for the phone to ring going, this is just the most surreal day and evening. 8 o'clock at night, I got that phone call. Yeah. You're in tomorrow morning. Had the lumpectomy and I was told, we've got it. You know, we've got the cancer. Just go home now. Just isolate until we get the results of the cancer before we know if we're going to do radiotherapy or the chemo.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
After 4 weeks, I'm thinking, this has taken a long time to get the results of the biopsy to see what I need. Because they said 50-50 to chemo. I made a phone call. They'd got lost. They hadn't actually been done. So then I had to wait another week or two for the results to come through. They decided that actually the cancer wouldn't have responded. I was stage 2, grade 2, wouldn't have responded to chemo. So I just went straight into having radiotherapy. Initially, it was meant to be 20 sessions. Again, because of COVID, it was brought down to 10. So I had 5 regular and then 5 intense boosters. And then I was told that, you know, I was fine. They'd got everything. There was nothing showing in my lymph nodes that I had a small chance of a reoccurrence, but to just go and live my life. So from April last year, it was just, okay, brilliant. I had my cancer experience. I didn't find radiotherapy too hard. I felt like I'd got off lightly because I didn't have to have chemo.
Yeah.
I started tamoxifen, which is a hormone drug, a hormone blocker, which I didn't have a nice relationship with. But, you know, I'm like, okay, but I need to have this because it lowers my percent of it coming back even more. But then I kept getting this pain under my right rib all the time. And it was just niggling at me. We've got a lot of cancer on my dad's side of the family.
Okay.
So guys had done the whole kind of, you know, looked into it all. Is there a family history because of how much there is on my dad's side of the family? And they said, we don't carry the BRCA gene, but there's a very strong chance that we have a mutant gene that's not yet identified. And they said that they know that there's lots of these genes out there and over the years they're all going to come out, blah, blah, blah. But to them, that made me a slightly higher risk of a reoccurrence. And like a lot of people, disappointingly, I wasn't told of the symptoms of secondary breast cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was basically go and live your life. So I kind of started pestering them and going, I've got this pain in my rib. It's not going. It's getting quite bad. I'm sometimes having trouble breathing. And they were like, oh, it's probably just inflammation from the radiotherapy. You know, don't worry about it. And then one day it got so bad, I was on the phone to them and they were like, you need to call an ambulance. Called an ambulance. They took me into A&E, did an x-ray. There's nothing there. Don't worry about it. Go home. It's carried on. And eventually I had another oncologist who then said last, I think this was October, and I went, right, let's send you for some scans. Got sent for a bone scan, a bone density scan. You know, that just showed up the regular kind of early signs of osteoporosis, osteopenia that you can get with the drugs, but nothing to worry about. I sent for a CT and an MRI in December, January of last year, told that's fine. So sorry, when I said I was all clear in April, that was April the previous year. I'm forgetting now that we're in January of the next year.
No,
so I'm like, okay, I keep getting told they're all clear. Right, okay, so March last year, I'm like with Maya, right, okay, so this is just some pain then, just with the surgery and from the radiotherapy, let's just get on with life. Then I got a phone call literally a week later and said, don't panic. Somebody has looked at your scan again. They want to do a PET scan. They've seen something on your lungs, but it's probably exposure to asbestos, maybe 20, 30 years ago, and 1 in 100 people will have this on their lungs, but they just want to rule it out. So I was like, okay, fine. And they said, so the PET scan is the gold star of scans. If there's anything there like this, it will show up and we can just basically tick a box, rule it out. So that was fine. Went for this PET scan again, not thinking anything of it. and I got a phone call at home. May the 6th last year, I was painting my front door. I got a phone call and they said, so we know we told you you were all clear. Actually, you're not. You're stage four. You lit up like a Christmas tree. It's spread. It's in your lungs. It's in your liver. It's in your pelvis and an abdominal lymph node. And I also had a brand new breast cancer, grade one, growing on the skin of the breast that I'd had the lumpectomy and the radiotherapy on, a completely new separate cancer as well. So it's just like that call of that line that changes your life forever.
Yeah, wow.
Because nothing will ever be the same. And I had to let that absorb. I was still standing at the front door with a paintbrush in my hand because I wasn't expecting this news, this call. I went through then anger, like, why are you phoning me? Why are you telling me this on a phone call? I could have been driving my car.
Yeah.
You know, my daughter could have been next to me. You didn't even ask where I was. So I focused on that. I was just like, you know, how dare you tell me this way, this life-changing news? I didn't cry or anything at that point. I didn't cry until I put the phone down. And I tried to phone my mum and I couldn't get through to her. And I got through to one of my best friends. I just burst out crying on the phone to her. She got in the car, just drove down from Sutton. My sister came over and I couldn't get an appointment to see anybody then for about another 4 days. So we spent that whole weekend. Some friends came, my sister came. I didn't tell my daughter. Didn't want her to know anything that weekend until I had a plan. I needed a treatment plan. And I wasn't given that on the phone. I was just told, you know, the odds of survival with secondary breast cancer aren't great. You know, blah, blah, blah. All very, very negative. So it was a horrible, horrible weekend. And I had to hide that from Maya for this whole weekend. And just said, oh, everybody just wanted a spontaneous visit to hang out with us because the weather's so lovely. I had this appointment. I was given a treatment plan, but it was all really negative. And that wasn't good enough for me. I did a load of research over that weekend as well. The same as I did with Asherman's, just tons and tons of research. Reached out, joined some support groups, joined some Facebook support groups, the Instagram community, which is amazing. The secondary women on Instagram and that community on there is just absolutely incredible. Found people through them who advocate for themselves. And they were like, no, you know, you would not just get this treatment. There are other options out there. This is rubbish. Don't take what this one oncologist has said to you.
Yes.
You know, there's not much we can do. Make your plans. Get your paperwork in order. It was just so doom and gloom. So I refused to see him and insisted on seeing somebody else and sat in the waiting room just literally refusing to budge until this other oncologist came out who I'd really, really good things about and saw him, and it was a game changer. He is really up to date on treatments, far more positive about outcomes, about quality of life, about things you can do with your life, about the new drugs coming out. And so I did my treatment plan with him. So this was all in May of last year.
Yeah.
Just decided, right, I'm going to enjoy every single moment of life, live that life of all those things that you go, oh, I shouldn't do this. Or maybe in a few years I should do this. So the one thing I said to my daughter was the following weekend after being diagnosed is, what would you love to do this weekend? If we could do anything, what would you want to do? And she was like, oh, I'd love to go to Paris. That's the only thing she'd ever talked about in lockdown, is how she wanted to go to Paris. She developed a really bad fear of flying during lockdown and was like, I can't go, I can't get on a plane. But she said, I want to go to Paris. I'd really love to go. But she was like, if we did a Eurostar or something like that. So it was Thursday night.
Yeah.
I phoned up my friend who lives in Sutton, the other side of Gatwick too, where we live to Gatwick. It's only a half an hour for both of us to get to. I went, do you want to go to Paris tomorrow? Because she's got a daughter the same age and they're great friends. We went online Friday morning, booked a flight, got a hotel, and we just went, got the girls, met at Gatwick, and we just flew over and we had the most amazing spontaneous weekend. And we didn't talk about cancer at all. And I was just like, this is what we need to do. We're just going to do all those things for 3 years where we hadn't gone on holiday. We hadn't done anything because of COVID and the primary breast cancer. And then I had to move house. I'd gone through a divorce through all of the COVID lockdown and through my primary treatment, which I think added on a massive amount of stress, and then having to move house. And I thought, my daughter doesn't need this. She needs some fun now. Yeah. You know, she needs to also just have a lot of fun. And we just had the best summer. Just like literally the best summer. We just did all these spontaneous trips. We were doing them all cheap and cheerful. You know, I wasn't going crazy spending money. We were doing these cheap and cheerful weekends. And then my mum was like, oh, Maya's always wanted to go to Dublin, hasn't she? Right, I'm taking you girls to Dublin for 4 days. And so we just did things like that. And then another friend was like, oh, you've always said you wanted to go to Marrakesh. Let's go to Marrakesh. And it was just fun, spontaneous, cheap and cheerful trips. And with my sister, we went to Rome with her girls. Again, just like Airbnb'd it, last minute hotel a few days beforehand. And those events, you know what? The treatment, I was feeling far better on all the treatment than I was on that one drug for my primary breast cancer, Tamoxifen, because I think I probably was dealing with secondary breast cancer and it wasn't being treated, obviously, and I was feeling tired, fatigued, run down, dreadful. As soon as I went onto the right treatment and my brain got into the right place of going, okay, this is what I need to do, for a minute my energy levels were back up. I felt healthier and better than I'd done for a very long time. And like, for me, just joined all the support groups again, met loads of women with secondary breast cancer, joined that community who are just wonderful. And we all get it. We've all been there. We're all going through it. We all share the same fears, the worries, but the positivity between them is inspiring. And women who've been living with it for years and going, okay, these are the people I want in my life.
It's inspiring. So, Sophie, that is so inspirational, your positivity, the way you've dealt with things, and, you know, like, I'm going to live my life how I want to live my life is just absolutely fabulous. If we could just finish off today's interview, because we know you're going to come on again, which is brilliant. Where are you at the moment and your future? What is it for Sophie Blake?
Right, so I'm now on my first line of treatment, which is when you get diagnosed, you go on lines of treatment. I'm on my first line of treatment, so I'm not on chemo. I'm on these inhibitors.
Yeah.
Touch wood, they're working really well. I have regular scans, PET scans, to monitor how they're working on the cancer. My last one was fantastic. It's no longer in my lungs or my liver or my pelvis or the abdominal lymph node.
Wow,
sorry, there is a tiny bit left in the liver, but not a lot. So my next one is next week, and I'm obviously hoping for an even better result. Yeah. The best thing anyone said to me was that living in fear isn't living, right at the beginning of my diagnosis. And I just thought, do you know what? That's so right. I don't want to spend every day worrying about what if, when could things get worse, you know, because none of us know. None of us know what's around the corner.
Absolutely.
And I just want to, I know it sounds incredibly cheesy, and I'm not going to lie, of course I have down days, and I have down days where I worry and I look at my daughter and my heart breaks. But the main side of that is the time that we have together, I want to be great as much as possible. I mean, I've got to be realistic. You know, I can't go and just have these spontaneous holidays all the time unless I win the lottery. But, you know, I want to do more trips with her like that, because it put her in a fantastic place as well. My future is now. I'm focusing on my daughter. That she's got her GCSEs coming up this year, so looking into going to college. So the next 5-6 months is just going to be all about her and making sure that she gets to where she wants to go for her dreams and her future, and just keeping a good routine, keeping her in a good place. And then hopefully we're going to have lots more adventures in the summer, and doing all I can as well to help raise awareness of secondary breast cancer and metastatic breast cancer, and supporting the NHS, obviously, because of what they're going through at the moment and the crisis of it all and how difficult that's affecting people with their treatments. And yeah, so that's where I am at right now. I'm in a good place. I feel good. I don't feel ill. I'm a bit tired, but that's mainly because of the medications that I'm on. Joined a gym last week, so I'm back into the gym.
Wow, good.
And yeah, I want to feel strong as well. I think exercise is really important, a good diet.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not perfect. I love my treats. I've not gone down the complete vegan, dairy-free, you know, juicing side of it all. Everything in moderation and a good balance.
Brilliant.
And enjoy life, but, you know, be sensible at the same time, but also just have lots of fun and enjoy the time.
Well, Sophie, it's actually quite sad that we're bringing this to a close today. I know you've got to shoot off. Just chatting to you, you are inspirational. Whether you like to hear it or whether you feel it, you are. Not only what you're going through now, what you went through after the birth of Maya, what you went through with your dyslexia. If you're happy for me to say this, it would be a challenge for most people to have one of those. And you've made yourself a successful career. You're a great mum, and you're doing that despite having three of them. So,
thank you.
You know, there's definitely space for us to work together with charities and gaining awareness.
I'd love to.
In the future with you for your charities. And definitely, definitely, definitely next month, I'd like you back on again so that we can talk to you about how things are going, you know, how things have progressed, whether we've now got rid of everything in the liver, if you know that.
Fingers all crossed for that.
Yes. So for today, Sophie Blake, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very, very much, and best of luck and best of health.
And thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Sophie.
Thank you.
We finish this week's show with our SLB Sports Roundup featuring golf, horse racing, motorsport, NBA and football. We start with golf. The PGA Tour hosted the World Golf Championship from Austin Country Club, and it was won by Sam Burns for his fifth ever win on the tour. He beat Cameron Young 6-5 in the final, a rather one-sided event. Cameron Young now having a few second places and just waiting to win that big one. The two boys did deserve their place in the final, having battled out with Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy, respectively, to earn their place. This week it's the Valero Texas Open from the TPC in San Antonio. The DP World Tour held the Johnson Workwear Open from the club at Stain City, and it was won by German Nick Backham on -24. He finished four shots clear of two South Africans, Henny du Plessis and Xander Lombard. This week there's no event as they prepare for the joint event between themselves and the PGA Tour. The first major of the season, the US Masters from the famous Augusta National. The LPGA was back with a drive on championships from the Superstition Mountain Golf and Country Club in Arizona, and it was won by French woman Celine Boutier on -20 in a playoff with English Georgia Hall at the first hole. One shot further back was Ayaka Furu from Japan. This week, they travelled to California for the LA Open from the Palos Verdes Golf Course. Horse racing, the Dubai World Cup was last weekend. Both selections that we mentioned didn't run as well as we expected. And the Dubai World Cup was won by Japan with the horse Ushba Tsutsuro. Equinox, another Japanese horse, won the Shima Classic on the bridle and in track record style. What a performance. Surely challenging Flightline for the best horse in the world. And Lord North won the turf, rounding up Frankie Dettori's time at the Dubai World Cup with a winner on his last appearance there. The Lincoln is this week, the first big handicap of the flat season. We've already given you Awal and Atrium, and we'd like to throw Al Mubir into the mix. We hope those three can take the places. The Grand National, we've already given you Korek Rambler, Noble Yates and Delta Work. We did say Galliard de Maynil if he went, but we think another Willie Mullins runner might take his place there. And if he does, he's got the form to run a big race, Mr. Incredible. Motorsport. NASCAR had the Echo Park Automotive Grand Prix from the Circuit of the Americas. It was won by Tyler Reddick, driving his Toyota Camry for 23XI Racing. Kyle Busch enjoying a new lease of life. Now he's switched to Chevy Camaro with Richard Childress racing was second. Alex Bowman was third, also Chevy Camaro, but this time for Hendrix Motorsport. Ross Chastain in a Chevy Camaro for Trackhouse Racing leads the championship standings on 211. Second place, Kyle Busch. As we said, Chevy Camaro also, but for Richard Childress Racing. Third place, it's a tie. Both drivers driving the Ford Mustang, Joey Logano for Team Penske and Kevin Harvick for Stewart Haas Racing, both on 186. This week, it's the Toyota Owners 400 from Richmond Raceway. IndyCar are back this week for the next round in their championship with the PPG 375 at Texas Motor Speedway. And onto two wheels, MotoGP had round one with the Portuguese Grand Prix from the Algarve International Circuit. This held the inaugural sprint race, which sadly, Ennio Bastianini fell and broke his collarbone. And the main race was won by current world champion Frankie Bagnaia for the Ducati Lenovo team. Maverick Vinales was second on the Aprilia, and Marco Bezzecchi was third for the Valentino Rossi 46 racing team. Formula E had round six from Sao Paulo with the Brazil E-Prix. It was won by Mitch Evans for Jaguar TCS Racing, second place with Nick Cassidy for Envision Racing, and third place Danny Bird for Jaguar TCS also. The standings are led by Pascal Wehrlein for Tag Heuer Porsche team on 86 points. Second place is Jake Dennis for Avalanche Andretti on 62. And third place, Nick Cassidy for Envision Racing on 61. Formula One is also back this week with the Australian Grand Prix from Albert Park in Melbourne. On to NBA and some important results with just a handful of games left of the regular season. Bucks 130, Spurs 94, Bulls 91, 76 116, Lakers 122, Suns 111. Nets 114, Cavaliers 116, Clippers 127, Thunder 105, Grizzlies 151, Rockets 114, Jazz 116, Bucks 144, Golden State Warriors 120, 76ers 112, Kings 135, Suns 127, Lakers 116, Thunder 111, Heat 100, Nets 129. Nuggets 129, Bucks 106, Kings 121, Jazz 113, Celtics 137, Spurs 93, Cavs 108, Rockets 91, Magic 119, Nets 106, Hawks 119, Grizzlies 123, and Golden State Warriors 96, Timberwolves 99. So with just 7 games left of the 82-game regular season, this are the top 10. As we know, the top 6 go straight into the playoffs. And 7 through 10 have a series of playoff games to get the final 2 spaces to make the 8 playoff spots. In the East, the Bucks lead the way on 53-21. Celtics a second on 52-23. 76ers a third, 49-25. These three are guaranteed playoffs. Fourth are the Cavs, 48-28. Fifth are the Knicks, 42-33. Joint sixth are the Nets and the Heat. That's how close it is, on 40-35. Joint eighth are the Hawks on 37-38, tied with the Raptors. And tenth are the Bulls, 36-38. In the West, the Nuggets are guaranteed their spot. They lead the way on 50-24. Grizzlies are second, 47-27. Kings, 45-29. And this is where it comes really close. The Suns are fourth on 39-35. The Clippers are fifth on 39-36. The Warriors are sixth on 39-37. The Timberwolves are seventh on 38-37. The Pelicans are eighth on 37-37. The Lakers and the Thunder are joint ninth on 37-38. It is that close. We finish with football. No Premier League, just the Euro qualifiers, which we bring you the results of next week. The WSL was in action. The results were Everton 1, Liverpool 1, Tottenham 1, Arsenal 5, Reading 2, Brighton 2, Manchester United 4, West Ham 0, Manchester City 2, Chelsea 0 in a big upset, Aston Villa 5, Leicester 0. That leaves the WSL table with Manchester United on top, played 16, 38 points, plus 33 goal difference. Manchester City are second, the same record, but their goal difference is 20. Chelsea down to third, 1 point behind on 37, but a game in hand to go back top if they win it. This weekend's fixtures: Brighton versus Manchester United, Arsenal versus Manchester City, Everton versus Tottenham, Leicester versus Reading, West Ham versus Liverpool, and Aston Villa versus Chelsea. That's our SLB Sports Roundup. Well, everyone, that's the end of another great show, an absolute blockbuster with one of the most incredible and inspirational people I've ever met and had the privilege to interview, Sophie Blake. We thank Sophie very much. You, the listeners, we also thank, and Johan, Rafaela, and the team from UK Off Radio for the amazing platform they give us. We'll see you all next week.